It's 10:01 and you are tuned to WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill, 99.9 Bangor, and streaming online at WERU.org. And welcome to this WERU special. I'm Amy Brown. Today we'll be hearing Professor Alex Grab of the University of Maine speaking on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Palestinian statehood, and the crisis of Israeli democracy. The talk was part of the University of Maine's Socialism and Marxist Studies series. It was recorded by John Greenman and has been edited slightly for length. Professor Doug Allen introduces Professor Grab.
It's a pleasure to introduce Professor Alex Grab from the History Department. And Alex is one of the key people in our program in the minor, and he has he teaches a course sometimes on the Middle East, and he's lectured widely on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's been a great resource for us over the years. He's also kind of fiendishly clever. Did you notice how he's manipulated things so that he got the UN to convene, right, to talk about Palestinian statehood, simply to generate interest in his presentation today? I think it's worked. So
I should mention this was recorded last Thursday.
On the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Palestinian statehood, and the crisis of Israeli democracy.
Okay. Thank you, Doug. And thank you, everybody, for coming this afternoon to hear me. I hope that you will gain some enlightenment, better understanding of what's going on. Tomorrow we are going now, of course, the Palestinian state issue is very, very big in the news. Tomorrow there will probably be a vote in the Security Council about recognizing a Palestinian state. And I think next week there will be a vote in the General Assembly of the United Nations. So it's very much, and I knew that this would come in September, so therefore I suggested also to speak about this. Now, much has been said in the last month, since the beginning of the year, about the Arab Spring, right? I'm sure everybody is familiar with these. Leaders have been toppled as a result of popular uprisings in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya, following a very bloody war. Their uprisings continue in Yemen, continue in Syria with a tremendous amount of oppression of the demonstrations. Less, however, has been said in the media on the internal situation in Israel. And this is the changes that are going on there in the last couple of years. And this is what I would like to devote a little bit my talk at the beginning to enlighten you about what is going on in Israel. I call it the crisis of the Israeli democracy, and I will explain to you exactly what I mean. So I'll start with the situation in Israel, and then I will move to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the current request of the Palestinians to recognize themselves as a state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and also talk, of course, about the American position on all this. Now, in the beginning of 2009, Israel had elections. Israel has elections every 4 years. It's a multi-party system. And in those elections in 2009, right-wing parties were able to gain a majority and to form a coalition and a government under the leadership of Prime Minister Netanyahu. The name is probably familiar to many of you. He is the prime minister. He comes from the right-wing Likud party. In the coalition, there are also several religious parties. Israel has several religious parties that run for elections, and they always get quite a few votes. So several religious parties, again, also in many ways taking a right-wing positions. There is also a party that represents the settlers, the Jewish settlers in the West Bank, and of course also their right-wing. And very, very important is the third largest party in Israel, and this is a party called Israel Beiteinu, which in Hebrew means Israel, our home. And it's led by a man by the name of Avigdor Lieberman, just same name as the senator in Connecticut, Avigdor Lieberman. And Avigdor Lieberman is definitely not just right-wing, but even extreme right-wing. And this is even the, in an article that was published on Sunday, Thomas Friedman even labeled him as such, and indeed he is. Lieberman is a person who came, is a Jewish person who came from Russia. I'm not sure exactly when, but at least 30 years ago, has been living in Israel now for many years, became involved in politics, and then founded this party that I was talking about, Israel Beiteinu, and he receives large number of votes from Russian immigrants to Israel, Jews and also non-Jews, who immigrated to Israel over the last 25 years and support and identify with his platform. And his platform is very much anti-Arab. Maybe I should explain that when I say right-wing parties, right-wing politicians, I mean here specifically their position vis-a-vis the Palestinians, vis-a-vis the Arabs. In other words, they don't want, these right-wing parties do not want to make any concessions to the Palestinians, do not want to see the Palestinians establish their own independent state in the occupied territories, which Israel has now been occupying since 1967. Netanyahu, of course, says that he supports the two-state solution, but in reality, nothing really happens as a result of negotiations. So the end result is that there is no Palestinian state. So that's what I mean by right-wing. Very rigid, very uncompromising position vis-a-vis the Palestinian issue. And also, of course, continuation of building settlements, Jewish settlements in the occupied territories, specifically in the West Bank, because Israel moved out of the Gaza Strip. And mind you that I should hasten to say that those settlements are not only moral because they are established on Palestinian land, which is literally taken from the Palestinians, both public land as well as private land, but they're also illegal according to international law. You can occupy foreign land according to international law, but you cannot make any changes in the land that you occupy. You certainly cannot establish, you cannot send people or your own citizens to settle in those territories that you occupy. It's completely against international law, very, very explicitly, very, very specifically, and yet Israel has done it with impunity for the last 44 years, since 1967 or 1968, since the time that it occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So there's a constant violation of the international law. By now, we have in the West Bank about 600,000 settlers, right, that were settled there over the last 40-odd years, in more than 200 settlements, and also what they call outposts. Those were kind of settlements that were established spontaneously by some Jewish extremists, right-wing extremists, also religious people who believe that this is God-promised land, and therefore they should settle there, and it belongs actually to Israel. So, of course, for the Palestinians to establish a state, those settlers have to move out. Now, how do you move out 600,000 people? This, of course, is very, 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 very difficult, if not impossible. Now, what I also want to emphasize about this right-wing government, and I'm reading here an article that was written, that was published as an op-ed in the New York Times last week, by a professor, an Israeli professor in Tel Aviv University, professor of psychology. I don't know him, by the name of Carlo Strenger. Right, you Carlo Strenger, you can also find it in the New York Times of last week. And basically what he says, Netanyahu's partners, in other words, the leaders and the parties that participate in the Netanyahu government, right, democracy's enemies, right? This is the way that he entitled this article. Hence, when I say the crisis in the Israeli democracy, you can see basically where it leads. He says that he talks about, for example, about Lieberman. Lieberman, by the way, is the foreign minister in the Israeli government. I mean, this is a very, very important position, of course. Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman has a very different worldview. Mr. Lieberman's open disdain for European leaders and diplomats is not failure of diplomacy. He is a shrewd man who first and foremost seeks to cultivate an image of a strong leader for his right-wing constituency. He believes that the West's hegemony has come to an end and that the future lies with autocratic governments like those ruling Russia and China. Hence, he believes that Israel has no reason to pander to the West's values, right? Basically meaning liberal values, democratic values. And he continues, to him, liberal democracy represents weakness, and he contends that Israel should evolve into a stronger state with less individual freedom. At the same time, he is completely secular, right? I mean, he's not a religious, and his constituency is primarily of Russian origins, right? In other words, people who migrated to Israel from Russia. Now, remember, he's a very, very powerful person. And he has, of course, ambitions eventually to lead Israel, to replace Netanyahu as the foreign minister. So this is a characterization of Lieberman according to this article. Now, he continues, the national religious parties in the governing coalition, meanwhile, are based on belief that the Jewish people have a God-given right to what they call the greater land of Israel. In the long run, those religious parties want Israel to be a theocracy based on biblical law, okay? A theocracy based on biblical law, maybe something like Iran, only Jewish law instead of Islamic law. Their participation in the democratic game is based on the prediction that Israel's demography will inevitably lead to an Orthodox Jewish majority, and that they simply need to make sure that Israel doesn't give up the West Bank before they rule the country. So they hope, of course, in the future to become the ruling majority or to have the majority within the population. And I should add that demographically there is an increase in this component, this Orthodox component in the Israeli population, because many of those people have many more children than the secular Jews. Right, again, it's part of the God orders, right? Multiply, et cetera, et cetera. So at any rate, they have families with 6, 8, 10 children. So their calculation is eventually we will become a majority. We will establish a theocracy in Israel. Now, whether it will happen, of course, remains to be seen. But at any rate, their power is definitely pretty big in Israel. So on the one hand, you have Lieberman. On the other hand, you have the religious parties. It's a kind of funny coalition because Lieberman is secular, right? The religious parties are based themselves on religion, but both of them are very, very rigid, very, very uncompromising when it comes to the Palestinian land and, of course, the establishment of the settlements in those territory. And of course, they all collaborate with Netanyahu, and Netanyahu, of course, is dependent on them for his governing coalition. If he will alienate them by making concessions to the Palestinians, like recognizing the Palestinian state now in the United Nations, they will simply withdraw from the coalition and his government will collapse. There will be a new coalition. Maybe somebody else will be elected. So this is something to remember. And again, not much is said in the American media about this kind of components, which are getting very, very powerful. Now, let me also add a few laws that passed in the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, in the last few years, which again show this kind of erosion, what I would call erosion of democracy. It's not, sure, there's freedom of speech, you can speak freely, you can demonstrate and all this stuff. So I'm not saying that Israel by any means is a fascist country or whatever. But what I'm saying is that there is an erosion, at least on the margins, with this kind of people, with this kind of politicians, of the Israeli system. And this is the view of quite a few Israeli liberals, the fear that in this there will be this erosion. So, for example, the Knesset, under this government, passed a law that prohibits the public commemoration of the Palestinian disaster of 1948. In 1948, the Arabs, of course, lost to Israel. As I'm sure many of you know, this is known as the Nakba. And Palestinians or Arab citizens of Israel have commemorated. For them, it's a disaster. Of course, for Israel, the victory was very, very big. But anyway, they commemorated it. Now it is forbidden to publicly commemorate this this Nakba, this event of 1948. Another law that passed is a law that allows Israeli communities, towns, to set up admission committees that and have them the right to veto new residents. And this is particularly anti-Arab. In other words, if Arabs move to a Jewish town, etc., those committees can deny, can negate the Arabs from settling, from buying an apartment there or a house. Well, just imagine to yourself that there would be here admission committees in various towns in the United States that officially would prevent a black, for example, person from moving in. Now, it's true that maybe a lot of Americans don't want to live in communities with black people, but at least you don't have some such such committees, and I think that this will be heavily denounced. The Knesset is now also considering legislation that would create commissions to investigate the financing of Israeli human rights groups. There are human rights groups in Israel. They are operating, and the government would like to restrict them. So investigating the financing, where they get the money from, et cetera, of course, aims at restricting their activity, limiting them, and intimidating them. But probably the worst law that was passed was a law that outlaws calls and attempts by groups in Israel to boycott Israeli companies, Israeli products, and especially products that come from the occupied territories. You see, in the occupied territories, you have about many, many settlements, and they produce certain things, sometimes using material from the West Bank. And progressive Israelis, progressive groups, human rights groups, leftists, etc., call to boycott those products because they consider the settlements of the Jewish settlements in the West Bank as illegal, as immoral, as an obstacle for peace. So they think that by hurting those communities economically, not buying their products, this will weaken their position. And for example, when I go to Israel, and I go at least once a year, for example, I don't buy wine that is produced in the Golan Heights. The Golan Heights was taken from Syria in 1967, still under Israeli control, and there are, I'm not sure exactly how many settlements, there are about 15 or 20 settlements there. One of their products is, for example, wine, and they produce very good wine. I don't buy this wine, again, as a move to, as a kind of boycott, and I know that this is the case also with large number of other Israelis. Now the government said, the law said, that you cannot call for a boycott of Israeli companies, Israeli products, and also products from the territories, and it allows the targets of those boycotts, like those, for example, settlements, to sue groups that call for the boycott. Now, this is a clear law that restricts freedom of speech, right? Because also in the United States, we have all kinds of calls for boycotts of all kinds of movements, organizations that we don't like, and this is, of course, permitted. Now in Israel, such groups can be sued. Mind you, that even Netanyahu understood this and understood that it can be very heavily criticized, especially abroad, and he did not vote for this. He was absent during the vote on this law because he understood very, very well the significance of such a law, but nonetheless, the law passed. Let me just read to you a citation, or a couple of citations by a very famous Israeli. The name won't say much to you, but in Israel, the man is very, very famous. He's a politician, but now he's retired. He used to be the former education minister. He must be in his 70s, but still very active in terms of writing articles, etc. His name is Yossi Sarid. And here's what he said in reaction to this boycott law. He says, "We are dealing with a nationalist fever. The Knesset, the Israeli parliament, was taken over by a savage tribe." Now, this is very, very strong language. "By a savage tribe called up by rabbis, settlers, and other moonstruck and sunstruck delusionists." Right? This is, you know, if you think, democracy is struggling to defend itself from those eating its flesh, okay? And over the last year, I received all kinds of emails and articles from Israel, and I received a couple of petitions that were passed among Israelis, but also people outside Israel, to sign against what they call the creeping fascism, okay? A creeping fascism, a kind of slowly creeping fascism in Israel as a result of all those laws and as a result of this coalition that is ruling over Israel. In other words, some people are very, very concerned about this tendency and about the power of those extreme right parties. For example, an Israeli professor in the newspaper Haaretz, which is the Israeli New York Times, very liberal on the territories, called this one of the darkest chapters in Israeli history. Okay, so in other words, those are developments that are, you know, should worry anybody who is concerned with democracy in Israel, with liberal in Israel. Still, of course, you can still write and talk and demonstrate, etc., etc. But the question is whether there's no tendency by those right-wing parties towards restricting all kinds of liberties. Now, add to this also a movement that has been very, very active in the last 3 months. Started actually in the middle of July, which indicates a social crisis in Israel.
You're listening to a WERU special. This is Professor Alexander Grab of the University of Maine speaking at the university last Thursday, September 22nd. The talk was part of the University Socialism and Marxist Studies series. It was recorded by John Greenman. It has been edited slightly for length.
Israel in the last 25, 30 years has been moving more and more towards the neoliberal ideology, the free market, more and more free market, right? Israel kind of started, and this is still the image that a lot of people have of Israel, kind of semi-socialist, social democratic government, equality, the kibbutz, etc., etc. Now, this is largely passé. Of course, there is still a welfare state and so on and so forth, but the neoliberal ideology, the free market system, has been, like in the rest of, in so many other countries, like including the United States and England, this has been very much a growing tendency. And what happened, of course, is that as a result of this, a few people got very, very wealthy, very, very rich, accumulating more and more property and making all kinds of profits. And there's a growing gap between the people who are, you know, kind of middle class, lower middle class, and the upper class. Israel, I should say, which is really an amazing statistic that, again, I don't think many people are aware of. Israel and the United States, by the way, are the two countries that have the largest social gap between rich and poor. Israel and the United States, out of all the countries that include, of course, England, France, in the industrial world. And this led to a crisis and to protests in the last 3 months, since the middle of July. What was established in the middle of Tel Aviv was a tent city. It started with a woman who was kicked out of her apartment because she couldn't afford the rent. And she was completely fed up with the rising prices in Israel, the fact that she couldn't afford housing, and she simply took a tent and put it in the middle of Tel Aviv in a boulevard under a tree. And pretty soon, more people joined her. And right now, the boulevard, which is pretty long, I mean, it's maybe a mile, has got a whole tent, you know, a line of tent on both sides of the street. And it became really a center of a lot of discussion about what's going on in Israel socially, about the rising prices, about the fact that many people cannot finish the month. I mean, we are talking here not about the abject poor. We are talking about here middle-class people who simply don't earn enough to pay for their monthly expenses. And it became, of course, very, very widespread. It spread also to other cities, Jerusalem, Haifa, and many other places. And every Saturday, Saturday night, they have huge demonstrations protesting this social gap, protesting the fact that housing is unaffordable, higher education is not as accessible, prices in general. And in those demonstrations, in the last few weeks, last few Saturdays, hundreds of thousands of people participated, 300,000-400,000 people with banners shouting and calling. The main thing is calling for social justice, affordable housing, and so on and so forth. You know, I got some YouTubes about this, and you know, you can see in the banners, etc., etc. And again, call for social justice. Largely, their discourse is social democratic. They want the government to intervene. They want the government to help them. They want the government to expand the welfare state and help people who are less fortunate, and so on and so forth. The problem, however, with this movement, at least from my perspective, is that they do not talk. They talk only about social justice for the Israelis. They do not include in justice also the Palestinians. So only about 10, 15 kilometers from Tel Aviv and from other cities, there's an entire population in the West Bank, the Palestinians, who don't have basic human rights, who cannot even move freely, whose land is taken away. This movement does not talk about them. And the reason that they don't talk about them in their call for social justice is because a lot of Israelis simply don't care about the Palestinians and, in fact, are very hostile to the Palestinians and seeing the Palestinians, of course, enemies. And the leaders of this movement are afraid that if they will include also the Palestinian issue and the Israeli oppression over in its rule over the Palestinians, then the movement will lose much of its power. A lot of people will withdraw from this because they only want to deal with their social issues, with their economic issues, but they don't want to include justice for the Palestinians. Now, mind you, that the plight of those people who demonstrate in Israel is definitely connected with the occupation because Israel has spent over the last decades billions of dollars, by the way, in part your money too, because America, of course, supports Israel very heavily. Billions of dollars on building settlements, building infrastructures, roads, electricity, water. And so this money is spent in the territories instead of being spent in Israel proper. Okay, Israel within the 67 border. Of course, the occupation also means a continuation of the conflict, means that the need to spend billions of dollars also in the military to buy all those planes and so on and so forth. So once again, money is being spent on the military. Of course, there is less money on social spending. Of course, this is the same situation also in the United States, in any other country. So what I'm basically saying is that not talking about the Palestinians and some kind of solution of the Palestinian problem and justice also for the Palestinians is contradictory and definitely, in my opinion, needs to be included. I understand why they don't, because, again, a large number of Israelis will then withdraw from the movement because they don't want to talk about the Palestinians. They only want to talk about their economic and social difficulties. And, you know, this brings me to talk about the occupation and about the conflict with the Palestinians. I've done it in this forum quite often. I don't have here the time to talk about the entire history of this conflict. This conflict actually goes on for more than 100 years. Of course, the important period for us is the last 44 years since 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And as I said, Israel resorted to a policy which, in my opinion, it's not a matter of mistake because Israel did it on purpose, but it created a huge obstacle to any agreement, to any compromise between Israel and the Palestinians. And I'm talking, of course, about the settlements which I mentioned earlier, hundreds of settlements built in the West Bank on Palestinian land by now 600,000 settlers. Again, remember, how do you move? I mean, this is a huge lobby. This is now a huge group in Israel. How do you move them out? If the Palestinians want to establish their own state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, of course, those settlers have to leave, right? They cannot just stay there. And so, but how do you move so many people? Remember that there's also a lot of support for those settlers in Israel proper. As I said, you know, the parties that are now ruling over Israel are very much in support. And those settlements, by the way, are expanding as we speak. Okay, more and more housing are added every year, more and more people, and so on and so forth. So it looks a very, very difficult situation to solve. Another thing that maybe should be mentioned is that negotiations between Israel and the Palestinian leadership over some kind of a compromise, over some kind of a settlement, has been going on since 1993, 18 years. But again, a lot of ups and downs, which again, I don't have time to talk about. But the main thing is this. Those negotiations have been going on. And the point of these negotiations in the final analysis is to enable the Palestinians to establish an independent state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. For this, of course, as I said, Israel has to move out, definitely stop the settlements and so on and so forth. But the negotiations have not produced any such state after 18 years. And this is the reason why the Palestinians, out of despair, not that they oppose negotiations, at least Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Palestinians in the West Bank, not that they oppose negotiations, but they said, look, 18 years hasn't produced anything. It did produce, you can say that it did produce something, because Israel did withdraw from the big cities in the West Bank, Ramallah, Nablus, Jenin, Bethlehem, etc. So the Palestinians have control over those big cities, but again, the surrounding and the countryside is basically controlled by Israel. So as soon as they move out of the city, they can be stopped, and etc. by the Israeli military. So in other words, those are kind of Bantustans that exist in the West, being enclaves. But of course, what they want is to have a contiguous state, right? A state that includes the entire West Bank. And here the Israeli governments over the years, including, of course, this one, have no intention to allow this to happen. Now, of course, what the occupation and the frustration of the Palestinians, of course, led to resistance. Resistance that continues to exist, including terrorism, including the rise of a movement like Hamas, right, which is a fundamentalist group that does not even recognize Israel and take a very, very extreme position vis-a-vis the whole conflict. They also oppose, by the way, Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Palestinians. They oppose also his talks with Israel and so on and so forth. So this, of course, adds to the complexity of the entire conflict. I should add here that in 2002, this is now 9 years ago, all the Arab countries met, the leaders of the Arab countries met in Beirut, in Lebanon, and they came out with a declaration that they would recognize Israel and they would make peace with Israel. All the Arab countries, at that time it was even Saddam Hussein, because he was still in power. But what they want Israel to do is to evacuate the occupied territories and allow the Palestinians to establish a state next to Israel. This is, by the way, is known as the two-state solution. Israel within the 67 border, a Palestinian state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. This is the two-state solution. They were talking about this. And they said full recognition of the state of Israel if Israel evacuates. And again, they were talking about negotiations, and they did not really dictate anything about negotiations. But they said, withdraw to the 67 borders, allow the Palestinians to establish a state. You will have full recognition by all the Arab countries. It looked like a pretty reasonable solution to me, okay? All the Arabs recognizing, Israel did not respond to this. In 2007, they repeated this declaration. Once again, nothing came out of this. Essentially, I would say most Israelis, or at least a very, very large chunk of the Israeli population, don't have any trust in the Palestinians. Basically think that the Palestinians and the Arabs are keen about destroying Israel, that if Israel gives up those territories in the West Bank, they will use it as a terroristic basis against the state of Israel. They will shoot all kinds of missiles, as they have done also from Gaza. So there's really no mood in the Israeli public. Not everybody, but large chunks in the Israeli population to make any concessions out of fear that the Palestinians will use this against Israel. Now, Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Palestinians in the West Bank, is super moderate. I mean, Israel will not find somebody who is more moderate. The person already for many, many years have denounced terrorism, have recognized Israel, have talked with Israel, etc. He replaced Yasser Arafat after Yasser Arafat died in 2004. There won't be anybody who is more moderate. Of course, Hamas is a different issue because they have a very radical platform. But with Abbas, an agreement can definitely be reached. Of course, then you establish all kinds of security arrangements for both the Palestinian and the Israeli state. But again, he did not accomplish anything, despite his moderation. Now, why was Israel capable of, again, as I said, violating the international law for all those years by establishing settlements? Why is Israel capable of still maintaining control over those territories after this? Now, of course, Israel is very, very powerful militarily, but it definitely has to do a lot with the support of the United States. The U.S. support for Israel is very, 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 very crucial, and it has been going on for many, many years, for many, many decades. In other words, the United States never said to Israel, look, you will continue to get our support, but you have to stop the settlements. There were always, the U.S. always said, we don't approve of the settlements. This we don't approve, but the United States never took any measure to put teeth behind this opposition. And of course, teeth, I mean, to take away the economic aid. Israel is the biggest recipient of American aid. $3 billion a year are given every year in the form, of course, of war material, planes, et cetera, to Israel. The United States, as we know, if it wants to put teeth behind their policy, look at Cuba, and it can do it when they want to boycott or when they want to achieve anything. But the United States never did it. Why does the United States support Israel so staunchly? Especially in the Congress. The Congress is very, very much in support. I mean, Israel really basically gets a blank check to do whatever it wants, at least in practice. Number one, because Israel is a very staunch ally of the United States. And in an area that is important to US because of the oil, because of the strategic location, of course, now with the Islamic population, etc., Israel is a very, very staunch ally, very, very powerful ally. That also has to be understood. Very, very powerful ally, powerful army, powerful intelligence, and so on and so forth. So this, support for a staunch ally in this kind of an area is important to the United States. But there's another reason, and this is a very powerful pro-Israeli lobby in Washington, AIPAC. It's called AIPAC, an American-Israeli PAC. And they basically are very, very well financed, very well very well organized. And if anybody criticizes Israel, they will immediately put somebody to oppose that person. I'm talking about Congress or Senator. Basically, nobody wants to deal really with this kind of powerful lobby. And so those, I would say, probably are the two most important reasons for the staunch support. Now, what happened was the Palestinians hoped that this American position would change with Barack Obama, right? Barack Obama, also his speeches, he said, we're kind of more progressive than George Bush and previous administrations. The hope was that he will succeed in putting pressure on Israel to end occupation, to reach an agreement on the basis of a two-state solution. And this is what Obama said all along, that he disagrees with the settlements, that he's for the two-state solution, and a peace treaty has to be negotiated. But the truth of the matter is nothing was achieved. This is now almost 3 years that we have Obama, and nothing was achieved. This, of course, created huge frustration among the Palestinians. And basically what they say is this: look, we have been negotiating with Israel for 18 years, going back to 1993. What we got are a few enclaves, but no Palestinian state. Now, how long will we continue? And what, again, has to be understood is this, that Israel, the Israeli government, really stalls those negotiations very, very smartly and very, very well.
Again, if you're just joining us, this is Professor Alexander Grab of the University of Maine History Department, speaking last Thursday, September 22nd, at the University of Maine. Sorry, we're having some technical difficulties. We'll try to get back to this Alexander Grab speech as soon as we can. Again, we apologize for the technical difficulties. We're working on getting you this third and final part of Alex Grab's speech.
There were several agreements, by the way, that were achieved, and Israel simply did not fulfill. It also went to this over the years. There were agreements that Israel with Netanyahu. The Palestinians in those negotiations were ready to really make huge concessions. What concessions can they make? I mean, they can basically recognize Israel, live in peace, denounce terrorism, reach some kind of mechanisms that will protect Israel and the Palestinian state, the militarized zones, et cetera, et cetera. But of course, what they need is for Israel to agree to evacuate those territories. And this has never been reached. And also under Obama, who is supposedly the kind of the more progressive, the more liberal, et cetera, et cetera. And he also made, he made some very good speeches. He made a very big speech in Cairo, a kind of extending a hand to the Arab and Islamic population. He made other speeches. He tried to put also pressure on Netanyahu to end the settlements. And there was a rift between him, if you remember, a year or 2 years ago. But again, the Congress is completely behind the Israeli government and behind the supporting it. And probably there's only so much that Obama can make. Now, of course, he wants to run for re-election. He basically shows himself to be as a politician like anybody else. So now basically the Palestinians said, okay, we are going to the United Nations. At least there we'll get a majority in recognizing a Palestinian state. Now, mind you that this is not going to change much because in the Security Council, the United States has a veto. So they will not. What they want is a recognition as a state and they want membership in the United Nations. In the Security Council, where it will, I think, will be discussed tomorrow and voted tomorrow, the United States has a veto. So it will, and Obama already said, I will veto any decision to give membership to the Palestinians in the United Nations and to recognize them as a state. And in fact, he puts tremendous amount of pressure. The Americans put a lot of pressure on the Palestinians not to submit this kind of request for a statehood. And so in the Security Council, this will not pass because of the American veto. In the General Assembly, which has 193 countries, right, and the Palestinians want to be the 194, there the majority will vote for the Palestinian for a Palestinian state, for recognition of the Palestinians. They probably will get non-state membership. There is some kind of a mechanism, non-state membership, but this is not binding. And Israel can say, okay, you got the majority. We know that you will have the majority with all the African countries, the Asian countries, South America, and also would be quite a few European countries, but it's not binding. So nothing really will change on the ground in the territories and so on and so forth. This is true. But the Palestinians, basically for them, it will be some kind of a symbolic victory to show that the majority of the world support their quest for a state and for independence, and Israel is the country that does not allow it, together with the United States. Of course, for the United States, this is quite disastrous because it will be in a small minority supporting Israel. Therefore, Obama really wants to put pressure on the Palestinians not to submit it, because he doesn't want to be seen as, you know, I'm sure that also personally, Obama agrees with recognizing and giving the Palestinians. He said it. And I have no doubt that if Barack Obama had been a law professor in the University of Chicago, he would have initiated petitions among his colleagues to support the Palestinians. That, I mean, he knows it, right? But he wants to run for office. He doesn't need the Israeli lobby to be against him. Already, what's his name? Perry. Rick Perry, 3 days ago, lambasted Barack Obama for his terrible policy against Israel, such a staunch ally, et cetera, et cetera. So it's going to be an issue in the elections, as it always is. Obama doesn't want to add, you know, he's got so many other difficulties, doesn't want to add to this. And therefore, yesterday, the speech that he gave, he basically said, I'm going to veto it. Netanyahu was very, very thankful, very, very thankful to him. But, you know, the only way to solve this problem is indeed the two-state solution. But, of course, what it means that Israel has to evacuate the territories. And I don't see this being accomplished tomorrow, in the next few years, and so on and so forth. Again, remember, 600,000 settlers, how do you move those people out? Very, very difficult. And Israel, as long as Israel receives this fantastic support from the United States, they don't really care about the opposition of the rest of the world. They have anyway diplomatic relations and economic relations with other countries. Let me maybe finish by talking briefly about this current situation in the Middle East, also in regard to the Arab Spring. All these uprisings in the Arab world leads, of course, to more democratization in the Arab countries, formation of parties, etc. And of course, among the movements and the parties, I'm talking especially about Egypt, a party that was under Mubarak, the dictatorship of Mubarak, was forbidden to exist or to operate, is of course the Muslim Brothers, the Islamist movement. And definitely they will get stronger and stronger, and they of course are hostile to Israel. So Israel is now losing a major Arab partner in the Middle East, namely Egypt, with which Israel has had now relationships going back to 1979. This is now 32 years. So losing Egypt and having a hostile Egypt, this is, of course, will be a big problem for Israel. Another problem for Israel is the relationship with Turkey. Turkey is also a rising power in the Middle East. There was a big crisis last year when Israel attacked a Turkish ship that wanted to bring aid to Gaza that was besieged by Israel. Israeli commandos raided this ship, killed nine Turks. And ever since, the relationship between Turkey and Israel, which used to be very, very good, by the way, very, very close, also military, economically, you know, have been very, very, experienced, a rupture. What the Turks want is an apology for the killing of these nine Turkish citizens. Israel does not want, especially Netanyahu, does not want to apologized. The Turks would like also maybe to have some kind of a monetary compensation, and this led to a big rift between Israel and Turkey. So here's another major country in the Middle East which is now turning against Israel. So Israel, what you see is Israel is becoming more and more isolated in the region with this kind of Arab Spring. And the solution, the lack of solution of the Palestinian problem is, as far as I'm concerned, completely disastrous. Because this is the only way that Israel can merge and can integrate into the area is by evacuating those territories, allowing the Palestinians to establish a state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, the two-state solution, and hope that this will work out. In my opinion, it has a very, very good chance to work out this kind of an agreement. And but, you know, as long as this is not being solved, Israel will be increasingly isolated. More and more money will have to be put. Terrorism, etc., will increase. And who knows? And of course, the right wing, I should also add, the right wing parties in Israel, parties that I described earlier, will get stronger and stronger, which means maybe Israel is moving, I don't know, but maybe is moving towards a less and less democratic system, less and less liberal system with this kind of situation. Again, this is the future. It's hard to predict exactly the future, but certainly the tendency, the situation now does not look very good at all, both for Israel, both internationally as well as internally. So that's all what I have to say. Thank you for listening, and maybe we should open it now for another half an hour or so to questions, comments, disagreements, complaints, grievances, whatever you want. Yeah.
Let's make a heroic assumption.
Okay.
Barack Obama is reelected.
Okay.
What would you suggest he do next?
What do I suggest that he does next?
Not only when
he is elected, also now. I want him to recognize, to vote for a Palestinian state in the United Nations. I want him, or any president, to put pressure on Israel to stop the settlements, to reach fruitful negotiations with the Palestinians on the basis of a two-state, to evacuate many of the settlers. That's what I would like. But, you know, it's not just Barack Obama. Because this is the only way. I mean, the settlements are a huge obstacle to peace. I mean, and it only inflames the Palestinian resistance. I mean, how would we feel if Maine had been occupied by a foreign ruler who would take all our land and our backyards and our parks, etc., and would settle their own people? How would we feel? I mean, we would also resist it. Of course, terrorism is nasty, but occupation is at least as nasty, and in my opinion, is the basis for this conflict. The Israeli occupation, I consider, is the basis for perpetuating this conflict. Terrorism, Palestinian, the Hamas, their lack of recognition, sure. I mean, they also have to be brought into this agreement and to accept, you know, Israel, et cetera, no doubt about it. So they have to abandon this kind of extreme fundamentalist ideology. I agree. But, I mean, Israel has a lot to do in order to reach an agreement, and I want the United States to push Israel towards this. Will it be done? Who knows? Yeah.
I mean, if that's the basic idea, that the settlements are the source of the problem, and the general reason for the settlements is because of a religious notion that that land belongs to you, you know, you're talking about abandoning extremist views. I mean, as long as people have these religiously derived fundamentalist views of things, is it even possible there to be a solution?
Well, if these people remain a minority...
Which isn't the case.
Well, you know, what I'm saying is right now, the majority are not Orthodox Jews. What they hope is in the future to become a majority. Right. But remember, maybe they won't be able to become a majority, but together with Lieberman, who is secular and has his own agenda, which is not religious, but it's basically the same regarding the territories. And the settlers, many of them are not religious. Some are religious, but many of them are not religious. But they have, of course, every reason to want to stay because this is their home. Okay, so you take all this coalition and the Likud party, you know, which is again consists of several groups. Yeah, I mean they can, well, right now those parties are the majority, There are still large number of Israelis who disagree with this, who oppose it, kind of got more liberal. By the way, hate the power of the religious parties, the privileges. The Israeli government over the many years now has paid kindergartens, schools, all kinds of perks for those religious parties in return for them participating in the coalition. And Israelis, for example, Orthodox, the very Orthodox Jews do not serve in the Israeli army. Many Israelis who serve in the army say, this is terrible, they should serve just like us. It's now 3 years to serve in the army. Those people say, well, somebody has to pray. Okay, so these issues do divide, right? You have a very strong secular element in Israel, just people like myself, okay, who don't want to see, fine, you want to pray, you want to have your synagogue, fine, no problem, but don't have such an impact on the political system. But, you know, it's political system gives them the power to negotiate, and eventually they won't. Now, will they succeed? You know, I don't know. We'll see. 20, 30 years, I don't know, maybe never. But this is their goal. I remember several years ago during elections, maybe 10 years ago, I remember how one of their leaders, one of these religious parties' leaders, was interviewed in the television, and he said, what we want is to turn the Knesset, which is the Israeli parliament, to Beit Knesset. You know what is Beit Knesset? It's a synagogue. The Knesset to Beit Knesset. But that's what they want. Theocratic system. End of liberal democracy. Will they succeed? What I'm only saying is that the occupation, the conflict with the Palestinians, which of course increases the nationalist fervor and so on and so forth, strengthens those elements. And also from this perspective, if you simply want a liberal democratic state in Israel, okay, you're not terribly radical, just kind of mainstream liberal, you have to oppose the occupation. The occupation undermines the forces of liberalism and democracy. And therefore, I'm personally very disappointed. Of course, who am I to say? I live in Maine and these people are demonstrating. But I think this is a contradiction for them not to be able to include the Palestinian issue in their demonstration and to demand social justice for us and justice also for the Palestinians, meaning end of Israeli occupation. They don't do it. And that's a big, in my opinion, a big shortcoming. And by the way, I do not believe that justice can be established in Israel without solving the Palestinian issue. You cannot control and rule.
We're going to have to leave it there. You've been listening to Professor Alexander Grab of the History Department at the University of Maine, speaking at the university last Thursday, September 22nd, as part of the Socialist and Marxist Studies lecture series. It was recorded by John Greenman and was edited slightly for length by Amy Brown. That's me. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned. We've got On the Wing coming up next with a lot of great music from Mark Dyer here on your community radio station, WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, 99.9 Bangor, and streaming online everywhere at weru.org.
For WERU comes from The Apprentice Shop.